Chopin's waltz in A-flat, Opus 69, Number 1, played by Marian Kipura. And so this edition of Sunday Morning draws to a close. I do hope you found it as interesting to listen to as I did to compile, and I thank you for staying tuned. Next week, a new series starts, Mozart symphonies, both familiar and unfamiliar, and I've chosen the Paris Symphony, plus its discarded Andante, which we virtually never hear. Also next week, after historic Rome, historic Greece, and my sextet is by Tchaikovsky, the original version of his Souvenir de Florence, memorably performed by the Keller Quartet with the viola player Kim Kashkashian and the cellist Miklos Perenyi. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. And in the meantime, may I wish you a happy and healthy new year.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Neil Byners.
Two operas from Covent Garden on BBC Radio 3, launching our year-long celebration of the music of Richard Strauss. Strauss 150. Beginning with René Fleming in the composer's final opera, Capriccio. And as part of our Music on the Brink season, Elektra. Strauss at the Royal Opera House on BBC Radio 3, Saturday and Monday evenings at 7:30.
And now Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the South African jazz trumpeter Hugh Masekela.
Hugh Masekela is a jazz legend. Brought up in South Africa during apartheid, he left the country at 21 and spent the next 30 years in exile, releasing album after album, 43 to date, and performing alongside other great musicians like Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Stevie Wonder, The Who, and I could go on. He's still making music and touring the world at 74, and I'm lucky enough to catch Hugh here on a visit to London. A warm welcome to you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
I think you've been making music since you were about four.
Well, I was bewitched with music before I was four. I think at four is when my hypnosis from the gramophone translated into a solution for my parents, and they decided to get me piano lessons. But I just, like, I was always either singing or playing records on the gramophone. I had to wait for everybody to wake up so they can hold it for me, because I wasn't strong enough to hold it and wind it. But I sang with just about any record, you know, instrumental. I scattered along with them. If it was vocals, I sang. I didn't know what I was saying, but I knew all the words. And I got into a lot of trouble. In school, I was always at the principal's office. But most of the time, I heard music, and when they called my name, I would sort of come out of a stupor and say, "Yes, sir." They'd say, "What is the answer?" And I'd say, "Could I have the question, please, sir?" And I wouldn't have heard the question. And then, of course, that was the road straight to the principal's office. So I just heard music all the time.
You still have?
I still do.
I was going to say, you still have rather a mischievous glint to your eye.
So do you, Michael. So do you.
Takes one to
know
one.
It's a musician's curse.
So the kind of things that you were listening to then, would you have come across things like Louis Armstrong at that point?
Everybody had a gramophone. Hmm. And on the weekends, they would put it on their front stoop. And it was just cacophony. That's besides the drums and the marching bands and the pageantry. Yeah. That was all around, you know. There was always a wedding somewhere, so there was wedding songs. There was no television, so we had children's songs, and we played children's games in the streets. When I grew up, South Africa was just like awash in music, because there were, in the townships, there was a small community center, or municipal halls, and on Fridays, Saturdays, there was always a concert and dance. And on Sunday afternoon, there was a matinee, and we were not allowed to get in, but we'd climb on each other's shoulders and peep into the... I'm sure you've seen that in a lot of movies. And would actually sneak out of the house when the folks thought you were sleeping and go. And sometimes when you came back, they'd be waiting for you. And, of course, there was the belt or the swish. On a slow day, I was whipped at least 3 times. And half the time, I didn't know why, because I was listening to music in my ear, so...
Extraordinary that people didn't stop to ask themselves why this was happening, but just went on beating.
Yeah, well, it was an age of... and it's still like that. I mean, in African societies, children, when your father comes into the house, everybody keeps quiet. But I was a bad child, like you said. I had a glint in my eye, but I was restless.
And this first piece, Rockin' Chair, by Satchmo, is this a piece you remember listening to?
I heard this on a 78 RPM when I was 3 years old.
It's a Hoagy Carmichael song, isn't it, originally?
Yeah.
Let's hear it. And that wasn't on the record. That was my guest, Hugh Masekela. Must be rather bring it all back, I guess, hearing that.
It's amazing how clever it is because nobody sings the melody. The guy is like reciting it, talking. But Louis Armstrong was like the champion of like improvising on anything. And it's amazing that the whole performance is him singing the improvisations to the melody without it being there. And of course, he was just an amazing person. I always say in my performances when we do this that if it wasn't for Louis Armstrong, we'd still be wearing those blue velvet suits with the buckled shoes that George Washington used to wear and white wigs. You know, it sort of loosened up the world.
Louis Armstrong with Rockin' Chair, the Hoagy Carmichael song. How old were you when you were first given a trumpet?
I was 14 years old. Bishop Trevor Huddleston, who had gotten me my very first trumpet when I was 14 years old at school. He knew my parents, you know, being an activist and a part of the ANC. Huddleston called everybody creature, and he was friendly with everyone, tried to know everybody's, because he came to South Africa through the townships. He only knew South Africa from the perspective of Sophiatown, where he was the parish priest. And he'd always come by and say, "Creature, how are you doing?" and tousle your hair, you know.
He was a remarkable man.
Yeah, he was a really remarkable man. So I was in bed with a cold, and he said, "What would really make you happy?" You know, it was an indirect question of, "What is the matter with you, kid?" You know, and I was like, "Father, if I can get a trumpet, I won't bother anybody anymore." I said, "Are you sure, creature?" He called us all creatures. I said, "Yeah, I'm sure, Father." I said, "Okay. I only have £15. It's my last money. Take this note. When I was well, and go to Bob Hill," and he knew everybody at Polyak's music store. "Ask him to give you a trumpet." He was a Scotsman, a jazz bass player. I looked at the note. He said, "Father's crazy. Trumpet for £5? You know, 15 pound? Must be." But he got me, gave me a trumpet. Then Father Huddleston knew the leader of the Johannesburg Native Municipal Brass Band, Uncle Sauda, everybody called him, and he came to teach me how to play the trumpet, how to hold it, and to read music again. But I, you know, I'd read music on a piano. I'd been a piano player, and I played classical music for. So knowing the technique of music, I got the gist of the trumpet very quickly. In a month's time, I was playing melodies from the movie "With a Song in My Heart and My Dream Is Yours," and the other kids, my friends, were like, "Damn, you're playing, man!" I said, "Yeah, can't you hear?" And they went to Huddleston and said, "Give me a trombone, Father, please get any, give me a clarinet." And he used to go and hustle these instruments. And finally, we had the Huddleston Jazz Band.
And then came exile. You were 21, and this was after the 1960 Sharpeville massacre, in which 69 protesters were killed by South African police. How hard was it to leave South Africa, Hugh?
It was almost impossible in those days, especially if you're an African, you know, if you're an indigenous person, because you had to, like, have a letter from your primary school, from your nursery school if you went there, from your parish priest, from the local police office, from the Department of Native Affairs, from the township superintendent, from the township social welfare department, and you had to have £400 in deposits so that if you get stranded, they could send you back home, and guarantees from overs. So you needed almost to open an office. But from the time Huddleston in 1955 was deported, I think I wrote him weekly to say, "Please, Father, try and get me a scholarship out there so I can come." Because my biggest dream was to be able to have access to the kind of tutorship in music that was available outside South Africa. So even if I had been white, which is a word I hate, I prefer of European origin, I would have wanted to go and study overseas, because the level of education, you know, the people that I knew, from the Louis Armstrongs to the Dizzy Gillespies to the Clifford Browns and Miles Davises, had teachers that were not available to us, you know. And my biggest dream from the time I was 9 was to land in New York and be able to have access to that kind of, like, tutorship. And it took a very long time.
I know you love Bach. And, of course, Bach has often been thought of as a kind of jazz composer in a way. I mean, he relied on improvised bass and things like that, figured bass. And you particularly asked to hear some Bach played on brass, didn't you? The Art of Fugue.
Bach is one of those people who proves to you that the categorization in music is a lot of poppycock, you know, because it's either beautiful or it's not, you know.
Yeah.
But music, I think, in its own, is free of categories, and Bach is a great example of that.
Well, here is part of the Art of Fugue played on brass. Thank you.
so beautiful, man.
Stunning.
But, I mean, you know, what's amazing for me is that at that time, there were no tape recorders. Composer like Bach couldn't hear back what he was writing. It was all on paper.
The Contrapuntus No. 9 from Bach's Art of Fugue, arranged for brass by the American jazz trumpeter Johnny Glazel. We heard the London Gabrieli Brass Ensemble. Now, for many people, Bach is God, but there is also a kind of son of God in Miles Davis, isn't there?
Well, nature is God. I think that we should clarify that for forever. But again, some people just excelled in like their love for music, and it comes out in their performance. Like a person like Miles Davis, when he played, again, you couldn't categorize it. His voice is just so beautiful, and he did so many things. But any time that you heard him, all you had to hear was 3-4 notes, and you said, that was Miles.
This is from the incredibly successful All Blues from Kinda Blue. Thank you. Miles Davis and All Blues from the 1959 album Kinda Blue. Actually, it sold 4 million copies so far. Pretty amazing.
Well, it's a classic because it's never stopped selling. You know, I think I've bought in my lifetime about 10 copies because, you know, there's the people who come to your house and you go and play the record, but the cover is empty. I think in my house it's been one of the most stolen records. And many people have never heard it yet, you know. And when they hear it, they go, wow, when did that come out? It's way before you were even a romance, you know. But it's amazing in its structure, structural excellence.
It's very fascinating, Hugh Masekela, that at the beginning of the 20th century, composers like Stravinsky, Debussy and Ravel became fascinated by jazz and what was coming across the Atlantic from America, and it influenced their music. And Ravel, I know, is a composer you particularly love.
Well, Ravel, Debussy, Eric Satie, you know, just the French, they have their own thing that is the sound. Well, they're as passionate about how they feel about music as they are about how they feel about wine or about food. The thing is, it has something to do with like great appreciation of the good things in life, you know. But when it comes to music, man, they love it with a gentleness that you don't find in, you know, in other societies.
It's very life-affirming, isn't it?
Well, you know, the sneaky thing about, like, the French style is that sometimes you forget that you're listening to it, and you sort of have the tender parts where you could, like, fall asleep, and then, bam, 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 they wake you up again. It's like a rat bites your toe and then blows, you know, to soothe you. But very, very playful. You'd never think that it came from a classical composer, which goes to show you that category is a lot of... what did I say? Poppycock before?
That was the Rigaudon from Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin, the orchestral version. And we heard the Cleveland Orchestra conducted by Pierre Boulez. Interesting, Hugh, that he actually wrote that in memory of two brothers who'd been childhood friends who were killed by the same shell in the First World War in November 1914. And when it was put to him...
It doesn't sound that sad.
Well, when it was put to him that that sound, that didn't sound sombre enough and that it sounded quite light, he said, the dead are sad enough. in their eternal silence.
Right.
Music, indeed, to commemorate the dead of the First World War. You wrote one of the catchiest political songs as part of a campaign to release Nelson Mandela. And I think it started when Mandela wrote to you, didn't he, in a letter smuggled out of prison?
I was going
to
say, I didn't write it, you know. Mandela smuggled a letter out of Portsmouth prison to me when I was in Botswana, where we started a music school, because Winnie Mandela had trained with under my mother as a social worker. And, you know, we knew her from when we were little children, and she used to report back. And so he knew everything about me, you know, and he wrote it in the letter, and he was encouraging me. And I was like, here's a man who has been in jail for 20 years and is consoling me who is outside, you know. When I was just so blown, I went to the piano and started singing the song. My wife came and said, I don't know that song. When did you do it? When did you write it? I said, I didn't write it. Nelson Mandela just sent it.
Is that you on that trumpet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I hope so.
I love the way you were breaking that note. That was very good, just if we just heard just now.
Well, you know, we don't analyze what we do. I think it just comes out. And again, we just recorded this record. I didn't think it would go anywhere. The funniest thing about this song is that it never was popular in South Africa itself, because it came out at a time when there were different factions. You know, and the ANC hadn't actually become the ruling party, and other organizations felt it was an unfair song, and why wasn't the songs about their leaders, you know?
How do you feel now about the South Africa of today? Do you feel great affection? How do you feel when you...
Well, it's my home. I mean, it's my, you know, I think that we were all also, like, focused on liberation. You know, many of us who were so-called militant, is because we wanted freedom for our people. And once we got the freedom and, like, Mandela became president, we assumed that everything was going to go, like, as smooth as the world assumed as well. But then politics is another world. So I have, to a great extent, now disengaged myself from political commentary, because I've realized that I really don't understand the game. You know, we had a passion for liberation, but liberation is one thing. But government and administration is a whole other game, and other players come in, industry, international industry comes in, and like allies and what. And so now when people ask me political questions, I go, I thought I knew this game, but I don't understand it at all.
What do you think would probably have happened to you if you hadn't got away, if you'd stayed in South Africa?
I would have died very young. I would have died very young, because what was happening in South Africa, and like I say, I was not a member of any political organization, but I couldn't take any orders from anybody, and I would have gotten in trouble. I think that if I hadn't gotten a passport, I would have slipped out of the country. you know, through Botswana or Swaziland, but I wasn't going to stay there anymore.
Love next, Hugh Masekela. unhappy love, I'm afraid, and the wonderful Billie Holiday. This is a song you've chosen from her 1958 album, Blue Satin, isn't it?
Billie Holiday didn't have what you'd call the greatest voice, you know, and she wasn't the greatest technical singer. But when she, like, embraced the song, nobody could really express it like her.
You've changed. That sparkle in your eyes is gone. Your smile is just a careless yawn. You're breaking my heart. You've changed. You've changed. Your kisses now are so blasé. You're bored with me in every way. I can't understand. You've changed. You've forgotten the words I love you. Each memory that we've shared, you ignore every star above you. I can't realize you ever cared. You've changed. You're not the angel I once knew. No need to tell me that we're through. It's all over now. You've changed. You've forgotten the words I love you. Each memory that we've shared, you ignore every star above you. I can't realize you ever cared. You've changed. You're not the angel I once knew. No need to tell me that we're through. It's all over now. You've changed.
Yeah, pass me the Kleenex, please. This is not a commercial.
Billie Holiday.
Yeah, no, she's a... You know, there's three people that I'm sorry I never got to see live. I got to New York 5 years after they all passed away in the same year. It was Billie Holiday, Charlie Parker, and Clifford Brown.
Yeah.
You know? But when they embraced the song, you never forgot it, man. They just...
Billie Holiday with Ray Ellis and his orchestra. You've changed. You're always changing locations. You think you've got three homes across the globe, and you once said you love touring and only go home to change your clothes.
Yeah, well, I mean, I tried to make it funny, but to a great extent, the roughest part of being a known musician is the travel. And I thought it was, like, difficult before, but now with the airport securities... It's even like, I mean, by the time that you reach immigration, after standing in line to clear security, you're exhausted and you left home an hour before that. But it takes to get to the plane takes about 3 hours, and by then you're finished. And when you're doing one-nighters, and you have to fly to each place and then arrive, and then the next morning fly, you're just like, why am I in the gulag or something? But
well, one thing you could do while you're waiting in the queue is download this program and listen to it on your MP3 player. And if you go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website, it'll tell you just how to do it. Clifford Brown, then, that man that you described as the greatest trumpet player ever. I think you heard this when you were 14, just started the trumpet, and thought to yourself, I'd better give up.
Yeah, when I heard Clifford Brown play, I mean, at that time, the word is that at that time, Miles Davis was going through a very difficult addiction, you know, in the early 1950s. And then one night he heard about Clifford Brown and he went to listen to him. And it made him decide to straighten out his life. And he came back after that, like, really kicking. But Clifford Brown was just like, well, Dizzy Gillespie called him the all-time master of the trumpet.
And but curiously, although he saved, in one sense, Miles Davis, he actually died quite young himself, didn't he?
Yeah, he died in a car crash. I think he was 23 or 24 years old. And that was the saddest day of my life, because I was so attached to him that this song, I don't know how many times I played, but my grandmother used to sing it along with me, you know.
Thank you. Clifford Brown's Easy Living with John Lewis playing the piano, Art Blakey on drums, Percy Heath bass, Gigi Grice flute and Charlie Rouse tenor sax. You clearly are a man with irrepressible energy for life, Hugh. Are you on a fairly strict regime yourself now that you look so well and bouncy?
Yeah, well, I try to exercise as much as possible and as reasonably as possible whenever I can. I walk every day at home, and I, you know, bring my outfit, and I swim a lot. I do calisthenics that the person can still do at my age. The magical thing that I took up 10 years ago is Tai Chi, which I try to get everybody to take up because it's just amazing that the body is held up by the toes, the foot muscles, the ankles and the knees. And those are the parts that we never exercise. And Tai Chi like goes directly to them. That's why you see like the Chinese people so erect and even in their old age. And it has been the most amazing thing that I have ever put into my life. And the only thing I miss is my temper, because it has eaten that away too. You know, it's what this does to you.
Do you think that the reason that so many jazzers have sort of succumbed to forms of addiction, we've talked about it already, is because actually they're seeking something almost beyond where we are in their music making, and that kind of living on the edge can be dangerous?
I think it's peer pressure. You know, prostitutes are also drug addicts, and so are like pimps and doctors, and I think it's peer pressure, availability, and like I think that that's just a weakness. Take South Africa, for instance. Nobody in the world drinks like South Africans, but that's because liquor was illegal for 64 years for Africans to, so it became an industry.
Well,
just
you know
like
what they
it became
say,
an industry in prohibition everywhere else. You know,
you know what they say about convent schoolgirls?
No.
Well, I won't tell you in that case. Afterwards.
Can you say it on the air?
I'll tell you afterwards. You're going to end with Frank Sinatra. And I think this again takes us back a little bit to your teenage years.
Yeah, well, my parents were major collectors, you know, of the Andrews Sisters and Bing Crosby. And he used to whistle to Bing Crosby and... Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five, and of course Glenn Miller and the Modernaires and like the Dorsey Brothers and Nat King Cole. But my father was just crazy. My father had a tenor. He loved to sing. Although he didn't want, they hoped I wouldn't be a musician because I came from a clan of school community workers. When they found out that I wanted to be a professional musician, I had been tricking them, and then they thought I was going to school for 3 months every morning. I'd wear the uniform, but I was already in demand as a working musician. And the principal one day went to my father's office and said, but where is Hugh? She was a German nun from the Roman Catholic. So, where is Hugh? We haven't seen him for 3 months. And my father said, but he goes to school every day. And that night I was at home pretending to be doing homework. My father said, so... how are you, my boy? I said, I'm fine, Dad. He said, well, how's school? I said, oh, it's great, except they're giving us so much homework. I was pretending to do homework. And, of course, the next thing, I was flying across the room. And that night at midnight, I wrote a note to say, I know that I haven't made you happy, but this is the only thing I can hear. I can, so I'm sorry to disappoint you, but, hey, I'm gone. And I was off. And then about 2 weeks later, I was in the studio with some of the greatest musicians of the time, and they walked in with a couple of my uncles and aunts, and I was like, oh, today is the death of me. But when they heard me play and they would recognize all the musicians I was among, you know, my father just said, come home, son, it's okay. And that's how, when I was 16, I was allowed back home, and they became my biggest supporters.
That's a wonderful story.
You know, yeah. So he loved the Frank Sinatra, and during that time, he even bought, like, our first electric record player. And this was one of his favorite songs, Blow, Wind, Blow Away.
Well, a lovely song on which to say goodbye and to thank you very much, Hugh Masekela.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me to this passionate interview. I've never done anything like this. And all I can say is, may the ill wind blow away. Thank you.
go, ill wind, go away. Skies are oh so gray around my neighborhood, and that ain't good. You're only misleading the sunshine I'm needing, and ain't that a shame? It's so hard to keep up with troubles that creep up from out of nowhere when love's to blame. So let me rest today. You're blowing me no good.
Frank Sinatra's Ill Wind, ending this week's edition of Private Passions. Michael Barclay was talking to Hugh Masekela, and you can download the programme and many others from the series. Just go to the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website and follow the links. Private Passions was presented by Michael Barclay and produced by Elizabeth Burke. It's a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Well, next week, as part of Radio 3's Music on the Brink, examining the cultural life of Europe on the eve of the First World War, Michael's guest is the novelist Pat Barker.
If it's New Year's Day on BBC Radio 3, it must be a New Year's morning, and with it the traditional New Year concert of waltzes, polkas and quadrilles live from the Musikverein in Vienna. Vienna Philharmonic, conducted this year by Daniel Barenboim. And amongst the musical frolics from composers with the surname Strauss, a birthday celebration for Richard Strauss. Join me, Petrok Trelawney, in Vienna for the New Year's Day concert, starting at 10:15, live on BBC Radio 3, on BBC Television, and using the BBC Interactive Red Button service.
This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90-93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's 1:01, time for the news with David Cornett.
An explosion in a railway station in southern Russia has killed at least 13 people and injured many more. Anti-terrorism officials say a female suicide bomber caused the blast in Volgograd. It's the second bomb attack in the city in the past 2 months. Two men have been arrested, one on suspicion of arson after a fire on a North Sea ferry. Four passengers and two crew on the MV King Seaways were airlifted to hospital in Scarborough after breathing in smoke. The ferry had been sailing from Newcastle to Amsterdam but was forced to return to port in Tyneside. Five people are being questioned after the body of a man was found at a house in Newcastle-under-Lyme in Staffordshire. Detectives said they were trying to identify him and speak to his family. The leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage, has said some refugees from the civil war in Syria should be allowed to come to Britain. He said Western countries had a duty to offer a number of them sanctuary. The government has refused to let any Syrian refugees into the UK, saying it's better to offer financial support. A bomb has exploded outside a military intelligence building in northern Egypt. Four soldiers were wounded. It's the second attack on the security services in the area in the past week. On Tuesday, a bomb killed 16 people in a police compound in the city of Mansoura. A voluntary register of all breast implant operations is to be set up in England in the wake of the scandal involving faulty products supplied by the French company PIP. New qualifications for cosmetic surgeons will also be introduced, along with rules on the marketing of procedures. England's cricketers are facing the prospect of a humiliating 5-0 Ashes series defeat after losing the fourth test in Melbourne. The Australians were set 231 to win and won comfortably by 8 wickets, helped by a string of dropped catches by England's fielders. And the weather, a generally cold, dry and breezy day with plenty of sunny spells. Top temperatures typically 5 Celsius, although it will get up to 9 degrees in southwest England. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
And that was David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. In an hour's time at 2 o'clock in the early music show, the soprano Emma Kirkby will be choosing some of her favourite seasonal music from the Middle Ages, the Renaissance and the Baroque. But now we return to this year's Schwetzingen Festival for an all Brahms programme of violin and piano music, played by Frank-Peter Zimmermann and Emmanuel Axe. We'll hear two sonatas, number 1 in G and number 3 in D minor, but first of all, the FAE Scherzo. On the 30th of September 1853, Brahms called at the Schumanns home in Dusseldorf, carrying a letter of introduction from Joseph Joachim. The following month, Joachim himself paid a surprise visit, and Schumann proposed that a composite greetings sonata for violin and piano should be composed in his honour. Schumann himself wrote the slow movement and the finale, his pupil Albert Dietrich the opening movement, and Brahms composed the scherzo. Schumann eventually wrote two further movements to form a sonata of his own, but Brahms' scherzo in C minor is the only portion of the original work that's remained in the violin repertoire. In later life, Brahms became only too aware of the shadow of Beethoven. At this stage, however, he felt no such inhibitions, and he set his scherzo in Beethoven's favourite dramatic key of C minor, and he even went so far as to base it on the Fate rhythm from the Fifth Symphony. The trio section in the major is a sweeping, passionate melody for the violin, which makes a triumphant return in the coda, rounding the piece off in majestic style. Here to play the scherzo from the FAE Sonata are Frank-Peter Zimmermann and Emmanuel Axe.